All right, 312-981-7200. Our friend Kim Belware is in the studio. Kim, you've been here like many times. What happened?
I don't know. I'm so tired. Now everybody knows that I'm bad at directions, but if anybody knows me in person, they know that to be true already.
That's okay. You've had a long day.
Welcome to my inner circle, listeners.
Yes. I didn't know that you were bad with directions. But you know what? In fairness to you, where we're at now on Wacker here in Columbus, and there's the three levels of Wacker around, so it is tough to figure out. For the first two times, because I come underneath by the Tribune Tower, and then I just missed the 2 weeks ago. I missed the right turn, and it took me a few extra minutes to get
there. It's different on a bike. I drove.
Wait, did you?
No, I biked. I was down here on a bike.
You just rode a bike here?
No, I didn't. But I was down here earlier for all the press conferences.
Okay.
And biked down, because that's my pro tip. If you're ever covering a big heater case, bike there if you can, because then you don't have to worry about parking and finding a spot. I don't have a news truck, you know, I don't have to worry. So that's the benefit of always covering things at 26th and Cal or downtown or any of the police stations.
Sometimes that can be a long way to go, isn't it, from where you're at?
I mean, I live on the west side and I'll bike to Hyde Park for something. So
wow.
If it's in an 8 mile radius, it depends. I mean, some days I just don't feel like doing it, but today it was fine. If you had asked me last week, I would have definitely not done that.
See, that's so interesting because I see, you know, when I'm downtown, I see people, mostly messengers or delivery people on bikes all the time or people like early in the morning dressed up like they're heading to work. And when I'm walking like on Clark and Grand and in that area and I see these people going by, it just freaks me out. Like, I'm worried for them? Yes. I'm like waiting for a car to hit them. And like, I don't know why I have this irrational fear, especially in the winter, of being hit by a car. I just see myself laying on the ground.
It's
going to
slip on the ice.
I'm laying on the ground freezing to death and with like a broken leg. And that's like my worst combination of not only being hit by a car and bleeding. Like in the summertime, I don't worry about it because at least I would be warm. I know that sounds goofy.
You can drag like, yourself away.
Yeah, but like in the winter, I'd just be like freezing to death as my bone is sticking out of my leg. I don't know why.
There's something that feels very scary and lonely about how cold it is. You're just like, if I fall down, I stay here.
Yeah.
And this is where
and
my
this,
end
this
will
could be. It. Yeah, especially this winter. I don't know. I'm just getting old, I guess. But we brought you in here to talk about the mayor's race, but in the meantime, you've been very busy with the whole R. Kelly case.
Yeah, and I was in Aurora last Friday, so it's trying to take Friday off is just continually not working out well for me. But, you know, it was interesting in these situations. In Aurora last week, this was happening as a lot of developments in the Jussie Smollett case were happening.
Yeah.
At this point, I think, you know, locally, people are trying to focus as much as they can here, even though there's also huge national news still going on.
Right.
And the backdrop of all of this is a really critical mayoral race and really interesting aldermanic races where you have all but two having competitors. And then you get to this week, everybody, from what I heard from my friends who are at the papers and at the different broadcast stations, they said they were all waiting for the R. Kelly thing. This has been kind of coming down the pike for at least a week, week and a half. People have been waiting for, the needle to drop on this one. And a lot of reporters were afraid that it was going to come down the same day as some of these big announcements with Smollett. So, I mean, for as much of a break as, 24 hours or less as, they had one part of that dispatched yesterday. And then, today the big news came in. And then Tuesday we're going to be back at it. And then, into a runoff most likely.
Yeah. And Roger went away. I think Tuesday the weather's not going to be good too. And that's really going to affect things, won't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always, and this is a very, this is so interesting because as I think we're probably going to see some higher turnout, hopefully, because it's going to be such a competitive race and there's going to be a runoff. There's been more people than before. Everybody kind of grumbles about the weather unless it's, a rare, nice day for Chicago municipal election voting. But there have been more instances this year than I can remember in past years where people say, we really don't have to do it this way. We could change it and we could have our municipal elections in November or we could have them in the summer. We don't have to have them in February.
And what is the story? There must be some story. And I'm guessing it's like some corrupt like thing where they, if we have it there, these people will vote and these people won't. What is the history of why we do this?
I read up on this one time and I wish I could remember because now I can't recall the specifics. But I mean, everything that I've heard about it is more kind of in response to it, which is that, you know, this definitely, it makes it harder for people who are, you know, low income, who are elderly. Yeah. I mean, the people who always have access to vote, they're usually not impeded by things like weather. And the people for whom voting is the most difficult, this becomes even harder.
Yeah.
So, you know, it definitely has a way of, you know, continuing to disenfranchise in a way the people who already are sort of on the bubble when it comes to access to voting.
Yeah, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense because it's not like early March is, it could be 60 degrees and gorgeous, but
yeah.
There's certainly no guarantee of that.
There have been some good things. I mean, you can do same-day voter registration now, which is good, and you have early voting, and you can vote by mail. So,
right.
You know, there are some things that have been, some reforms that have happened that have made, you know, Chicago elections, you know, better. So there is that, but I am still in favor of changing the actual date to,
yeah.
You know, maybe mid-year, or I just don't understand why they don't do it during the same, you know, November cycle as everybody else.
And I want to say that some town, there was a story out this week that some town or city, or I don't think it was a state, has decided we're not going to take Columbus Day off anymore. We're going to make Election Day
a holiday.
The holiday,
yeah,
instead.
Was it Ohio? Everything's blurring together.
Right.
I did read that too. I mean, I'm still reading news from outside of our area, but yeah, for, you know, for the mayor's race, it's also expensive, you know. Because they could just, if they have to administer elections in November,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, you've already got all the people there.
Yeah, it's expensive to do this. I mean, I think they were pretty hard up for election judges last I heard last week. They were really scrambling to, you know, get people in place for that. And election judges, I mean, that can be huge because you always do hear some stories every cycle of whether it's the national elections or the municipal ones, polling places where the judges didn't show up on time or they didn't show up at all. And so things get delayed. And anybody who shows up to vote at that time, you know, they either have to wait or they leave and they might not come back. So,
yeah.
You know, they're really, you know, they get paid for it. So it's not quite volunteer, but I mean, election judges are really important
yeah.
to facilitating elections. And we kind of, you know, base it on like, I think about $150 and some pizza is about how we do it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting. All right. So let's, we've got to do news here in a few minutes. So let's cover R. Kelly for a few minutes. I was just reading the piece that you wrote for Vulture. If that documentary didn't come out earlier this year, would any of this be happening?
That's a good question. I definitely think you don't want to dismiss the impact that the documentary, the Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly that came out in January, that had, because it did give, that prompted Kim Fox, the Cook County State's attorney, to kind of issue this rare plea to say, you know, if you do have information about this, you know, please come forward. You know, it was seen nationally, so that might have encouraged some people to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
It does just bring renewed attention. You know, you're interviewing the people that have defected from R. Kelly's camp. You know, you definitely are building a critical mass of credibility for a lot of these claims. So I think that was huge. But, you know, like, God bless Jim DeRogatis. He's like been, he's been, you know, pushing at this, you know, in BuzzFeed, now in The New Yorker.
Yeah.
He's really been carrying the torch for this. I mean, he's not the only one. You definitely see more writing about R. Kelly in all entertainment publications, which Vulture is New York Magazine's entertainment vertical.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I'm really pleased that national outlets like this are trying to get Chicago people on Chicago stories too,
yeah.
which I think is good. But, you know, I think something was probably likely to happen, but something that has been so frustrating, whether you are a parent of a victim or you're Jim DeRogatis or you're someone else who's hoping to see some sort of accountability happen for R. Kelly, is that there just had been no charges and everybody was, you know, boggled by the fact that despite all of these, you know, credible allegations and just, you know, there's so much, and that, you know, the state's attorney said we can't do anything without a complaining witness.
Right.
I mean, so that's really what they were waiting for.
And he had faced charges before and been acquitted.
Right.
And I wonder if once that happens, if a prosecuting office is like, well, we did that and, you know, it didn't work that time. I know there's other people, there's other rumors and this and that, but I wonder if they kind of just like, you know, we're not going to keep doing that again. I wonder if that helps out. Once you get away with it once, you're more likely probably for them to say, well, we tried that already.
It's definitely, I mean, I think people always underestimate how much power the local prosecutor has, because they absolutely decide which cases they're going to pursue. I mean, they can say, we just don't have enough evidence. Yeah. We can't meet our burden. We're not going to bother. But there's something to be said, too, that public pressure, people saying, we really want you, you know, to look into this. If they do get a witness, they understand that there is, you know, a lot of force behind, you know, behind this for them to, you know, do as much as they can. And you know, cooperation from witnesses is going to be the huge thing here. You know, Dayor Geddes made a really good point today during the, you know, the press conference that I was at, which was that while he is going to, there's going to be a bond hearing tomorrow, I'm going to be in bond court, 26th and Cal. And as he, I'm guessing he's denied bond altogether. That's just my hunch. But, you know, as he, you know, goes in for kind of the next phase, if he's held without bond, whatever it may be, he still has the three or four women that have been living with him who, they're adults, they're not minors.
Right.
And whose parents haven't seen them in, you know, years in some cases, and are really worried about their safety, and think that he is, you know, controlling them and is, you know, keeping them hostage in a sense. And there was a well-being check, which I think I mentioned in the article. A tipster called the Chicago police. They did a well-being check at his Trump Tower residence in January. And these are adult women. They said, no, we're not hostages. So nobody's making the complaint. They say they're fine, they leave. And, you know, then Jim DeRogatis points out, well, they questioned these women in his presence, like classic domestic call, you separate the men and the women. And if you look at the documentary, his ex-wife, other people who used to be in his circle, they kept going back to the term brainwashing. And they talked to experts who talked about, you know, how all controlling, you know, this manipulation can be. So even if someone is talking to you, even independently, you don't suddenly snap out of it and say, yes, get me out of here.
Yeah.
Like you are really kind of in this sunken place.
Yeah. Very interesting. Sunken place from Get Out. 312-981-7200. It's 226. Let's take a quick break. We've got to do the news. I do want to actually talk a little bit more about this, because I'm so fascinated also by the fact that R. Kelly has all this money. I know he had a big hit.
I think money is running out.
Because he's behind on the studio, but he's got a Trump Tower. I mean, I'm just amazed by all
that. Yeah, I have questions.
All right, we'll talk more about it. Matt Bubala Show here on 720 WGN. More with our friend Kim Bellware after the news. You can follow her on Twitter at Bellwack, B-E-L-L-W-A-K. I always have to make fun of that. Make Sundays your official night to tour the city. Watch Chicago's Best at 10. Then stick around for the latest in shopping, entertainment, and events on See Chicago at 10:30 p.m. on WGN-TV. 2:30 in the morning. Let's check some headlines now with Roger Battish. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Let's not play R. Kelly anymore, Jess. That just feels weird. Let's just not do that. That was his hot song? See, I don't even know that song. I just know I Believe I Can Fly. Did he have a lot of hot songs?
Yeah.
Oop, hold on. There you go, Kim.
Yeah. I think there's also several stages of R. Kelly. There's kind of early Chicago R&B R. Kelly, where he was doing, you know, like kind of real R&B stuff. And then as his audience goes from being kind of more of like an R&B fan base to slightly more, you know, mainstream R&B and pop, you know, you see kind of in the late, you know, he does I Believe I Can Fly, which was like I wouldn't say crossover, because I don't want to say that he was niche necessarily. He was always, I think, a popular R&B artist. But, you know, he goes really, really broad with I Believe I Can Fly, because he was not that I want to in any way compare him to Prince. But when you look at Prince's discography, where he has a mix of like very mainstream popular things, he had some very sexual, explicit, you know, things. And then he had, you know, just kind of the whole mix. Like that's sort of, you know, that's how R. Kelly's career track. So, you know, he had like Step in the Name of Love, which is, you know, much older hit. And you guys, I Believe I Can Fly, Ignition Remix. You know, he had... I mean, there's several, and those are the only three that I'm pulling off the top of my head. But, you know, he had several hits, and he worked with Lady Gaga. You know, he did lots of duets with people. You know, he had the big tour with Jay-Z. I mean, when we were talking before the break about what's the situation with his money, and I said, I think money is running out, because while he has made you know, a great fortune selling records and touring. I mean, he's 52 and he is still touring. He's still putting out records. Not that 52 is that old or even that, you know, there's a real cutoff point. You definitely see people touring longer in their lives. But I think one of the reasons he is touring so aggressively is because he needs the money.
Yeah.
You know, his Olympia Fields home, I think, has been foreclosed on for several years. We did a real estate listing on that back when HuffPost Chicago was still around, and it was, you know, kind of in disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
His studio on Justine Street is, you know, he just, I think, had to close up on that. And I think he was renting the homes in, or home, at least, in Atlanta. But then you still hear reports about how he's, you know, flying women around, he's putting them in hotels or they're living with him. You know, he's supposedly living in Trump Tower right now, assuming like renting from that. I'm just very confused as to why he would continue having such high priced real estate when he also has very expensive legal fees.
Yeah.
And, you know, the talk always was, and I think, you know, Jim DeRogatis' and other people's reporting has alluded to this, is like there's been lots of settlements or other kind of payouts. So, you know, he's been spending money on more than just his, you know, maintaining his lifestyle. So I don't know where that money is coming from.
Well, I wonder, and I don't know how it all works, but he's got royalties that are always coming in, and maybe you borrow against future royalties or things like that. Did you ever read that article about Johnny Depp?
Oh,
last
yeah.
year,
I was just talking about it.
Article.
I was just talking about that today. I mean, the money management habits of the wealthy are fascinating.
Yes, they are. So who knows what he's had going on with money and things like that. I think it's very fascinating.
Well, and it makes me think of O.J. Simpson because, you know, you had someone who was probably okay financially, was still living like, you know, a pretty nice lifestyle.
I bet he was still doing pretty good because he'd been making movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't remember if he was still a spokesperson for Hertz or not, but
I think by the time the you know, Brown Goldman murder happened, I don't think he was an analyst for the NFL and I don't think he was with Hertz, but I think he was still, he was like doing appearances. I think he still had something going. And of course, you know, he has an NFL pension, you know, he had other sources of income, but it's that legal, you know, his legal fees is really what kind of, I think, nearly nearly bankrupted him.
Well, and then losing the civil suit.
And that too. So, I mean, it's going to be pretty interesting what happens. You know, I don't think I'm talking out of school here, but I keep bringing up Jim, but he's really, I mean, the one who's been on this the most and the deepest.
Yeah.
It was fascinating at the press conference because, you know, the old, it's both in legal and in journalism, you know, don't ask questions that you don't already know the answers to.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has more answers than Jim does. At this point, I think Jim probably knows more than Michael Avenatti does, than Kim Fox does, you know, in all but some of the sealed things that, you know, maybe he hasn't seen. Like, I don't think he's seen the videotape, but I think he has heard about it.
But he had seen the original videotape.
He'd seen the original, and, you know, he was really aggressive in, you know, questioning Avenatti, and Avenatti's not I don't find him to be very clear, you know, and forthcoming all the time because, like, mm-hmm. you and I were talking at the break, he likes to tease the info that he has. He likes to meet it out instead of, you know, kind of clearly and forthrightly answering questions completely. He was really evasive today in the press conference. There are four victims that are included in the indictment. So there are 10 total counts of criminal sexual abuse. And there are four separate indictments. There's a total of 10 charges. And three of those indictments involve girls who were minors at the times of the incidents, that they each spanned between like 1 and maybe 5 years all of the allegations span about 12 years, ending mm-hmm. most recently in 2010. And then there was one victim who was not described as a minor. And in this, you know, explosive, lurid videotape that Avenatti obtained and was talking about today at the press conference, you know, he said on the tape, both the girl and R. Kelly, I, identify her several times as being 14.
Which is so weird. I mean, when we hear about these stories, we tend to hear about somebody saying, who was the other person that this was just out with where, Ryan Adams.
Ryan Adams, yeah.
Yeah, with Ryan Adams and how he was texting this young girl and saying, you know, you are 18, right? Or like at least pretending that he cares that she was of age. But here, R. Kelly is like reveling in the fact, it sounds like,
that
she is underage.
Do you remember, I mean, that really famous clip? You can find it in grainy footage on the internet because R. Kelly's people, when he, I think, had more clout and money maybe to make this happen, R. Kelly's people got, I think it was either Vibe or MTV to pull it off the air, but it was a mid-90s interview with the journalist Torre, and Torre asks him, you know, do you like young girls? And instead of saying, you know, oh, of course not, no, that's ridiculous, you know, no, I adults, R. Kelly pauses and he goes, how young are we talking? And then he, you know, he's like, are you talking like 15, 16, 17? And the look on Torre's face when he hears him, I mean, he really tells on himself in that instance. You know, he had that illegal marriage to Aaliyah when she was 15, and they had been working together in at least a, you know, kind of protege capacity since before then. But anyway, in the, you know, in this video, getting back to Avenatti and his kind of evasiveness, he confirmed that the 14-year-old in the video is one of the victims who is only identified by, you know, her initials in the indictment. He would not say if that victim was his client. He would only say that one of the four victims is his client. And when people asked him, you know, can you clarify? Why can't you say? You know, it was like, I have reasons that will be revealed in several days, and you know, and then you know, you'll understand. And I mean, I think that's just so unsatisfying because you know he's saying, "Trust me," you know. You know, there's always language that officials and you know attorneys like to say, you know, not prepared to speak on it. But a lot of times he didn't give a good reason. He just said, "I'm not going to go into that." You know, like I'm not going to disclose that.
It's unfortunate because I do believe somebody like him or Gloria Allred is a showman as much as they are anything else. And I think like we talked about off the air, you understand a client who needs to get their story out there feels that they need exposure. These are the types of people you go to. But when he's obfuscating like that, you start doubting things. And that's what this case does not need, is any little holes for R. Kelly to be able to. I mean, he got away with this once before.
And yeah, and I think what felt really unsatisfying to me today is ultimately the focus should be on the victims who have survived this, who have lived with this. What's going to happen to them, you know? Who is helping, you know, who's kind of supporting them? Are they cooperating? Well, he wouldn't say.
And the women who are living with him, who maybe, like you said, they were interviewed in front of him. So who knows what kind of condition they're actually living in?
Yeah. Are they in danger now that, you know, things are kind of closing in? Well, and also, you know, there was some kind of like squishy language about, you know, who Avenatti's representing and, you know, the relationships. But then the things that were unequivocal were, you know, these very kind of showy statements he gave, which, you know, I didn't quote in the piece because I, you know, I'm not trying to give him attention for being boisterous, you know, trying to get the facts of this out. But, you know, he said things that are just, it felt like, you know, they're like kind of dangling bait in front of, you know, reporters for sound bites. You know, he said, I'm confident that, you know, R. Kelly is going to die in an Illinois prison or somewhere else in the U.S. And, you know, this really strong language that, you know, as a father, and, you know, like, that's great, but it's not, it's, that also is like feels very overconfident to me.
Right.
You know, you can say, I think a lot of lawyers would say they have a strong, you know, they have a strong case. They believe in their client. You know, they're confident that, you know, justice will be done. But he's, you know, going all the way, like he's going to be convicted. He's going to go to prison for his life. Yeah. He's going to die there. Like that is just very dramatic in a way that I don't think serves anybody.
And quite honestly, he did the same thing with the person he had for the Kavanaugh case. He was saying how this is gonna, you know, the allegations were the by far the worst allegations.
Yeah.
And they went nowhere. And I don't remember what happened with that, but I believe there was some discrediting that happened with that witness, and so he looks Like, he's this guy who's just going to yell all these things from the rooftop, and then you don't know what he's really going to follow through with.
I think what will be interesting, and I'm kind of borrowing the insights from, you know, Jim again, but, you know, R. Kelly is being investigated in at least two other states, in Georgia and New York. And there also is, you know, he reported for The New Yorker yesterday, I guess 2 days ago at this point, that he might be facing federal charges, you know, cross state lines, trafficking kind of thing. So there might be federal, you know, a federal indictment coming down. I think there is some reason to believe that if he ultimately does get, you know, does get caught by the long arm of the law, it's going to be in New York or by the feds. It's not going to be in Illinois.
Let me ask you two things about that. So the Trump Tower thing, you mentioned that there was a well-being check, but they were interviewed in front of him. Now that he's been arrested, he is in jail overnight until his bond hearing in the morning at the least. Do they have a warrant? Do they go back to the Trump Tower apartment? Are they talking to those women again? Are they following up on that now that he is not there?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you also, one thing that I think was useful that Avenatti pointed out is that you don't get to keep women in hotels and fly them all over the country and do these things without help. So he obviously has people in his circle who are facilitating a lot of, you know, these directives of his. So, you know, even if he's not there, does he have someone? I mean, I think you heard that too in the Surviving R. Kelly documentary, is there were women who talked about how they, you know, they would be watched by like a bodyguard pretty much, but not for their safety.
Right.
You know, really just to make sure that they didn't go anywhere and they didn't talk to anybody. So, you know, who knows what's happening inside there? Who knows who's kind of playing that role now? Avenatti did say that he had two, what he described as whistleblowers who had been in R. Kelly's circle for 25 years as, you know, two of the six people he was representing, two parents, two whistleblowers, and then two victims. But he only said that one of them he only confirmed that one of them was one of the victims named in the identified in the indictment. But an interesting thing, too, that another reporter friend told me is why he surrendered tonight instead of tomorrow, is that he surrendered to the police station, you know, downtown.
Right.
And so there's a bus that comes, like a van that comes and takes you to court to get processed and everything for your bond hearing. And that comes about 3 or 4 in the morning. So if you miss the bus, you're waiting for an entire day until the next one. So if you turn yourself in late at night,
shortest time that you'll spend.
Yeah. You're going to be processed, do your paperwork. You might, you know, sit in jail for a couple hours, or you'll sit in the station for a couple hours, but then, you know, 3-4 in the morning, you're on your way over to 26 in California, where you get processed again, and then your, you know, bond hearing, his bond hearing will probably be the first one of the day.
Now, you said earlier that you think he will be denied bond.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm his lawyer, I'm going to say, you know, these are egregious allegations. Of course, we're going to fight these to the fullest. And this was attempted once before, and he was found not guilty. And, Your Honor, he turned himself in. He faced these charges before. He plans on being here to clear his name. And he needs to be able to work. He needs a this or that in the meantime. He's not a threat or a danger. He lives with women that were just checked on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But do you think that they won't let him out? That's your guess, at least?
That's just my hunch. You know, it always just depends on how an individual judge, what's their standard for what constitutes ties to a community, what constitutes a risk. I mean, there's not, I think, it's still somewhat subjective, you know, for the individual judge that's doing that. And I don't know what else the state is going to, you know, raise tomorrow as objections to that.
And I wonder, it'd be interesting to wonder what kind of a flight risk he is. Could an R. Kelly get out of the country with however much money he has when he's so well known and this is such a big case?
I think if he's not denied bond, I think he'll get a very high bond. So maybe $1 million.
And then he has to post $100,000 in cash.
Yeah, which, I don't know. Yeah.
I guess that'd be interesting to find out if they do give him bond and he can't make it, then you'll really have a window into what his situation really is.
I mean, I just don't, I always wonder how, when you have that much money, you know, keeping, how many balls can you keep up in the air?
Yeah.
You know, when you're renting instead of owning and you, you know, maybe you're going deep into debt, like at some point all those bills come due.
Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating. All right, so it's getting late. Can you still stay around a little bit? I know you've got to be up early tomorrow because you've got to be back in court, but we need to talk about the mayor's race, too. Can we do that? All right, 312-981-7200. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to do the news, and we're going to talk about what's coming up on Tuesday with our friend Kim Bellware here on 720 WGN. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio. We're here with our friend Kim Bellware a couple minutes before the top of the hour, so we have some questions that we'd like to get in. For Kim here. Rita's on 720 WGN. Good morning, Rita. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing okay. My comment was, this person, Kelly, I know you're innocent until proven guilty, but I think he got away with stuff earlier. And what I am most concerned about, besides his predatory behavior, is that his victims, all of them, get help. Because if they don't get help, not just for their self-esteem, which I think is most important, it's going to affect the rest of their life. I hope that the people who, whatever they did or didn't do earlier, that they received help too, because their families, you know, here's a big car or whatever happens, they're not doing them any favors. They need to be able to function and go on and not associate with anyone that would mistreat them. And I mean, just, you know, his behavior, and you have to be watched and ask permission to use the facilities, and it's outrageous.
Yeah,
it would be outrageous for a regular person, much less someone who is a celebrity, quote unquote, has tons of money. You don't treat people like that.
Thank you
they're
so much.
They're not machines. Yeah. They're people.
Thank you so much for the call, Rita. I appreciate it. Well, celebrity or not, abhorrent behavior is abhorrent behavior. And, of course, people shouldn't get away with it. But you do wonder about these victims and what kind of treatment they've gotten in, especially when you've talked about that there have been settlements over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to the Michael Jackson case, and you read things about these settlements, and where it's, and those were really young kids, not, you know, well, I don't know how old the boys were in that, but they seem like more like 8 to 12 versus we're talking about 14-ish-year-old girls. But you wonder with the parents in these cases and settlements how that all worked out, and I don't know how things have turned out for those girls, because Rita's definitely right. You need a lot of counseling, I think, to get through something like this and move on with your life. You're going to have a lot of issues, you would think, moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important. And you know, even now, R. Kelly's lawyer is disputing these charges, and he's saying that the women say that they are survivors of this. He's saying they're liars. They're just, you know, they're just out for a payday. And, you know, I think that's unfortunately one of the challenges that, you know, all of these survivors are going to have to deal with is, you know, if they're getting support, if they're getting help for this trauma that they've been through. There's, you know, there are still, R. Kelly still has a lot of fans.
Yeah.
There are still people that are in his corner that are going to, you know, cast aspersions on their motives. And
well, I heard Bill and Wendy talking on the show, this is months ago when that documentary first came out, and they were talking about it, and they said his sales were really increasing.
I think his like Spotify listens, they got a bump from that. I mean, so there, and this is something where, as much as there's a lot of talk and a lot of kind of critical mass of attention about these really terrible things, you know, I was just, when I was watching the press conference with his lawyer after he surrendered today, all of the comments in the live feed were, you know, like, free R. Kelly, free R. Kelly. So,
seriously?
I mean, the internet comments are not a true metric of public opinion, but,
no, hopefully,
you know,
not.
It is, you know, it's not like his fan base has shriveled to nothing. He still does have a lot of fans, which is, you know, something that, unfortunately, the survivors probably contend with is, you know, harassment and being disbelieved and that sort of thing. But Rita made a great point.
Joe, I can't get you on the phone because we got to get to the news, but he wrote, how did the girls meet him? In general, do we know how R. Kelly would get a new girl into his life?
In, you know, when he was younger, but still quite a bit older than these girls, you know, there are, if you go back 20, 25 years, ask, you know, any black woman who grew up on the south side of Chicago, and she'll tell you that you'd see him hanging out at, you know, the McDonald's, hanging out at the high school, at the mall. One of his victims said that she met R. Kelly at his pornography trial. She went there to see him and to support him, and he, you know, saw her in the crowd, and, you know, they, you know, ended up, she ended up getting in contact, you know. So I don't know how he met some of the women who are not minors, but yeah, at least when he was younger, and in many cases they were fans.
He and Roy Moore can hang out and have a cup of coffee over how you meet women.
Yeah, it was fans, and it was people that he said he would work with in the capacity of being like a mentor, and they would be his protege. That was another.
You know, online, our own Spike O'Dell, who is a longtime afternoon morning host here at WGN, told a story. He's retired now. He's been retired for, I think, like 10 years. And Spike told a story online today that he and R. Kelly were principal for a day.
Oh, no.
With a big group of people back in the way back when. And he didn't know who R. Kelly was and misunderstood and kept calling him Art all day long. And so at the end of the day, it was like, good to meet you, Art. And he said, he grabbed his hand, sugar, pulled him in and said, it's R, like a capital R. And he was like, oh. And Spike said he got home and told his kids, and they were so mortified.
This is interesting.
They knew who R. Kelly was.
It's interesting because it's been pretty widely reported to that R. Kelly is, I think, functionally illiterate.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right. When we come back, let's jump into the mayoral race. Here, everyone's favorite weatherman, Tom Skilling, weekday afternoons at 4 on the Rocon Show with Anna DeVlantes on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. A couple minutes after 3, here's your news with Roger Badish. So Matt Bobby with you here on 720 WGN. Our friend Kim Bellware is still in studio with us. We're going to keep her up really late so she can be zombie-like as she walks around the courtroom tomorrow.
We'll all be zombies tomorrow.
Yeah, I imagine you guys will be. And it'll just be a circus. All right, let's forget about R. Kelly for a minute. You'll have enough of that on your mind tomorrow. We have a mayoral election in 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, whatever it is now, Tuesday. And there's still, how many people are on this ballot?
14.
14 people on the ballot. And so basically what happens in Chicago is if you don't get more than 50% of the vote, then if nobody gets more than 50%, then the top two vote getters are going to have a second election. We'll have a runoff, right?
Right.
And it's crazy to me that, God, there's 14. So I probably could name like six of them at best.
Mm-hmm.
And
you think we can name all 14 between the two of us?
I'm sure, but with you, yes, because you're covering it. But I don't even live in the city. I work here, but I don't vote. Mm-hmm. So I'm not that entrenched in it other than the fascination of it. And frankly, we've had so much going on nationally and now even locally that the mayoral race has kind of fallen off. I mean, I feel like I've read more about aldermanic races in some ways,
yeah,
than I've read about the mayor's race.
Well, it's a very interesting thing that you say you can't name all of them, because as I'm thinking through the list of all the names, I can see why that would be, because there's a lot of names that do not get a lot of coverage or any coverage. Yeah. And also, anybody who remembers the 2015 Republican presidential primary remembers how unwieldy those debates were. Yeah. When you had a stage full of 12 people, then you had like the junior varsity table
with
like Bobby Jindal and Carly Fiorina kind of thing. I mean, it's hard to do a substantive debate with that many people. So I understand why, you know, WGN and WTTW and some of the places in town that, you know, run really solid debates don't want to have a, you know, bench of 14 folks.
Yeah.
So they do cut it off. And I actually don't know how they did it. I know for the presidential debates, they do it based on how people are polling nationally, according to, you know, several agreed upon, you know, kind of reputable polls. But in Chicago, you know, for the last public debate that, you know, most of the most prominent candidates that you would see on WTTW, you had Tony Preckwinkle, you had Susana Mendoza.
Oh, wait, I was just going to start naming, see who I can name.
Okay.
All right. So I had Susana Mendoza and Tony Preckwinkle because they've sort of been fighting with each other, right? So that's why I know them so well. Are they the only two females running?
No.
They're down. Okay, all right, stop. Willie Wilson, mm-hmm. because he gets a lot of media and he runs these commercials and he's so distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Arnie Duncan?
No.
So, God, all right. But somebody else who was like a head of CPS is, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Hint?
Well, that would be your hint.
Yeah, but that Arnie Duncan was also that once too, right?
Yes. Thinking of Paul Vallis.
Paul Vallis, thank you.
That's, so that's four.
Off, Paul Vallis.
You need 10 more.
Okay. Well, I got Bill Daly.
Uh-huh. Five.
And then I've got, is Gary Chico?
Yep.
Okay, Gary Chico. And then Chewy is not this time.
Nope, he is should've. A congressman now.
We've got a former, who is our former head of the Chicago Police?
Gary McCarthy.
Oh, Gary. See, I had Gary written down. Okay, Gary McCarthy. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I really don't think I can get further than that. What's the next biggest name on that list?
Lori Lightfoot.
Lori Lightfoot. Okay, I've heard that. So that's three women running, right? So far.
Amara Enya.
Amara got a lot of notoriety early on because Chance backed her,
mm-hmm.
and Kanye sort of backed her too, right?
Gave her a lot of money. Yeah.
He gave her money.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard Amara. I haven't heard much about Amara since then.
I've heard, you know, this is also the thing is, I think during the election, our kind of echo chambers, you know,
yeah.
I've heard a lot about her, but okay. That's probably because of, you know, sort of a lot of the people that I talk to, a lot of teachers and a lot of, you know, kind of progressive women voters and, you know, people that I think are really in her and younger voters, you know, a lot of mm-hmm. younger voters, I think, like her a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been such a the two things that I've been hearing, maybe three things. The three things I've been hearing are that, oh, my God, the election's coming up and I still don't know who I'm going to vote for. I've also heard I feel conflicted about even the choices that I kind of like.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is, do I vote strategically or do I vote ideologically? So, and I don't know, I'm getting like very philosophical here, but I'm thinking of how narratives of who is a front runner and who is, you know, kind of like a viable candidate, mm-hmm. how that happens. And some people have said, you know, I've heard a lot of people saying that they like Amara, for example, but she doesn't have, you know, any experience running a big municipal executive like Chicago. You know, she hasn't run a big company or, you know, been the head of a, you know, a police force or a school district or anything like that. And they think, well, you know, maybe she doesn't have the experience. Well, people are asking that of her, but there are other people running who also don't have that experience.
Right.
Are they, you know, who we ask these questions of, and this comes up a lot, especially when it comes to women, you know, experience and likability are often gendered, you know, in political races. But a lot of people in the past 2 weeks have really been talking about Bill Daly as the front runner.
Even though he wasn't talked about the whole while. He was in the race for the whole time. We had a Daly in the race this entire time, like under the radar, which was the craziest thing ever.
I remember when he first declared, people were laughing about it and they were like, are you kidding? Like, this is beyond stale. He doesn't have a chance. You know, he was kind of like the Jeb Bush of candidates for this. And then he has been getting all this money from Ken Griffin, the state's richest man.
Right.
And so I don't, you know, is money alone what is influencing people's perception that Daly is a front runner? He did get the endorsement of the Chicago Tribune. He did, you know, I think he also got an endorsement from Crane's Chicago Business. So maybe, you know, does that speak to the, you know, power of newspaper endorsements still? He, you know, he got several big endorsements and he got a lot of money.
Yeah.
That seemed to be pretty much all I can think of as far as, you know, I don't recall him really cleaning up in any debates in a way that...
Well, he skipped the one debate very famously to get his plumber's endorsement.
Yeah.
My guess is that the thinking would be it does come down to money and manpower, and the money helps get the manpower, and the assumption I would guess would be that Daly's go way back in this town, and with union endorsements and things like that, you're going to have the people on the ground to get the word out and help get votes out. and that in the end, you know, the powers that be, like Cranes and the Tribune, are looking at the experience of people, and here's somebody who does have great experience, maybe not running a city, but certainly on a national level, he had good experience in the Obama administration. My guess is he's going to be one of the two.
That's my guess, too. And I'm trying to search of why I think that. And then I go back and money, what do you think are typically the things that turn people's heads? I think strong debate performance, people can kind of ride a wave of that. A lot of money definitely makes people feel like, you know, you're going to be able to bomb everybody with ads, as we're seeing. I don't watch a lot of television, so I've been able to avoid those, but my mailbox can't avoid them. Everybody's mailboxes, and they're getting bigger. The political mailers are getting bigger, so they're like the size of magazines now. So good debate performance, money, and then I guess endorsements, you know, getting Al Gore came to town and gave him the big endorsement.
Bill Daley got an endorsement from Al Gore.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting, weird one to me. I mean, you know, I love Al Gore and stuff, but he's really out of the spotlight now. He has no good tie to Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, if President Obama would have given him one, that would have been a big shot in the arm, you would think.
Yeah.
But he hasn't spoken up on this,
well,
right?
he also didn't even step in to, you know, throw a lifeline to Rahm when he was struggling after his first reelection. So I think that kind of set the bar for, like, he's not going to weigh in on these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, also a former chief of staff. So if he didn't do it for Rahm, he's probably not going to do it for Daley.
I think that the name is going to help him the most in the end. That in the end, most people, I would think, are going to see 14 names on this. They're not going to pay that much attention. And they're going to see a Daley there.
I'm very curious how recent transplants to Chicago will vote. People who did not live here under any one of the previous Daley eras.
I would think he wouldn't do as strongly with them.
Yeah.
I would think people that remember back when, and quite honestly, forgetting that we've been in terrible financial straits ever since the last Mayor Daley left.
Yeah.
But the city looked really good at the time. We didn't talk as much about all the murders by gun. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a different time. Now, maybe we're setting the financial seeds for ruin back in the day, but
parking meter deal.
But Skyway. But people don't think about that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ultimately, it's going to be the big things that, you know, big topics that have come up, obviously, gun violence, strengthening kind of like the economic diversity throughout the city, you know, getting it in neighborhoods and not just being a downtown mayor.
Yeah.
Definitely, what are we going to do about casinos in the city? What are we going to do about an elected school board? What are we going to do about TIF districts? I mean, there's a lot of things to consider. So I give credit to BEZ. They had a pretty masterful quiz of that you could take to find out who, you know, is kind of best aligned based on, you know, the issues. And, you know, admittedly, it's a little unscientific because not every candidate answered every question. And also some of them gave kind of wishy-washy middle of the road answers.
Sure.
But with every issue, they had a little link that said, you know, like, I'd like to know more about this. And you click it and it's, you know, a story about that issue. So it's kind of like an eat your vegetables approach to getting people to, you know, they're taking a quiz and they think, I'm not equipped to answer this. I don't know anything about the water reclamation district. And then, you know, they read it. So I do hope that people, you know, read up and do their homework. But it does go back to a lot of what I've been hearing. Do I vote strategically, which means, you know, do I vote for, if you don't want Daley, for example, you know, what I've been hearing the most, and I think polls would suggest this, is that Toni Preckwinkle, the current Cook County Board Commissioner, is the, you know, has been the kind of presumptive front runner for so long. And so the thinking is, even if she's not your pick, do you vote for her because you're pretty much voting against Daley?
Yeah.
Or do you vote for who you want? And I've heard the counterpoint of, you should absolutely vote for who you want, because saying we have to vote strategically is how we end up with with leaders that we don't like.
Yeah, because you've got to make sure your person gets into that top two.
Yeah, so if everybody votes for who they really want, maybe they'll really get who they want.
Yeah, but it seems like there's no, like, shining star candidate, that everybody has some sort of baggage, whether it's lack of experience, a daily part of a machine that wasn't good overall for the city. Tony Preckwinkle, I want to say, within her staff and things like that. Susana Mendoza, like all of these guys, I feel like the more I know about them, it's never because there's, you know, quite honestly, Amara
Enya
is the only one that I can think of where I, all my association with her is positive, like Chance backing her and like, you know, some positive that came out of that. But even with that, and correct me if I'm wrong, has Chance failed her a little bit? And you know, he's only got to do as much as he wants to, but he comes out, says he's supporting her, donates some money, but he hasn't done a lot. I mean, he could really make a difference in this race, I feel like, because there's such good glow around him right now. And if he really got out there and really was like, this is who will work for the city and work for the kids and da-da-da-da and all these things, I would think he could really motivate a lot of people. But I feel like he sort of dipped his toe in but then backed off.
Well, he had a what was billed as a, I think, like a bus to the polls or like bus to vote type of event where people were, you know, they were getting, I think, a lot of college students on a bus to go do early voting. And she was going to give, you know, some remarks and he was going to be there. And then he ended up not being there. And then, you know, her campaign said, oh, you know, we knew in advance the day before that, you know, because of a schedule conflict, he wouldn't be there. But, you know, the reports were that he was advertised to be there and he wasn't. And so that was probably a surprise to some of the people who attended.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it wasn't a very strong turnout. But everybody, you know, everybody certainly has, whether it's kind of unique baggage or shared baggage, you know, maybe Ed Burke is, you know, a name that comes up for a lot of them. But as people pointed out,
Ed Burke must be loving the last few weeks here in Chicago because I had forgotten about Ed Burke.
And remember, he's fighting for his own political life because he has at least two challengers in his wards.
Well, and his political life might be the least of his concerns at the moment.
I will say, I mean, Ed Burke is apparently giving out in the ward, I mean, hats, hams.
Good-looking Chicago hats, too.
I am a reporter, and I am impartial, and I, you know, don't kind of...
But you want one of those hats, don't you? You're going to admit it,
aren't you? Yeah, I want one of those
hats. That's a pretty cool-looking hat.
I do want one of those hats.
I don't understand the hams. That's some old-school politics.
I know, but I bet it works. And, you know, and I also... Where did I hear this today? I heard that he's, like, been going door-to-door, you know, really doing, like, the shoe leather, you know, getting out...
And the coat and the hat.
Yeah, and the fedora and everything. And, you know, he's working for it.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be fascinating. I mean, the aldermanic races, like you said, you feel like you've been hearing more about those. I mean, I think...
Well, the Tom Tunney race, because of the Ricketts family involvement and stuff, that one has certainly been out there.
How do you feel about the number of I mean, I know that you don't live in the city, but how do you feel about the number?
Well, I know there have been articles about, are there too many aldermen, right?
Yeah.
That we should cut this down. I have no idea. I like that each neighborhood has representation. I wonder if the aldermen do have too much power to completely shut down projects and things like that, because you, whenever you hear about, you know, and clearly that's the reason the Ricketts don't like Tom Tunney, but, you know, here when the Tribune Tower got sold and they made their proposals and the alderman was saying, well, I'm never going to let them block that view, and like, and it really comes down to an alderman just saying, yeah, we're not going to let them do this. That's amazing to me.
Aldermanic privilege.
Yeah, aldermanic privilege. And I forget who I was talking with this about whether that should really be or not, and there was an argument against taking it away, and I said, well, at the very least, you would think, because... And it made sense to me. Somebody was telling me, well, people on the northwest side shouldn't necessarily be deciding for the south side. Those aldermen live in that neighborhood. They work with those people, so it makes sense. And I said, but it's also so rife for corruption when you give such power to somebody. So maybe there should be, not necessarily take away aldermen, but I think like blocks of like four or five aldermen that have to approve things together for their area, you know, just so one guy or gal doesn't have all of this power to wield. It does seem amazing to me. Plus all that, the money that they get each year, is it TIF money or whatever they get, the $3 or $4 million that they can spend however they want within their district. I mean, it's amazing. You would think these people automatically are getting reelected because they've got a Christmas every year that they sort of can spread around the neighborhood. I remember when I was working with DNA Info, certain aldermen that were doing like online voting for with their constituents. How should we spend the money this year? Should we repair the sidewalk, or should we build a park, or should we do this or that?
Well, there's also the issue of, you know, this came up in the recent WTTW debate this past week, was should aldermen be able to have jobs? Because you can have jobs right now.
Well, and that's the thing. And that's what's getting Burke in trouble, right? Yeah. They're recommending the law firm. And Madigan has a law firm. And all these people have law firms. And you always wonder, like, why do they get into this job if they have this other thing? And it seems like, well, of course, to feed work to it. And it just...
Doesn't Tom Tunney own the Ann Sathers?
Ann Sathers, yeah.
But the... all of them have some kind of other business. And the job pays... The job pays
like
well.
It's like $100,000, right?
Yeah, it's, I think it starts, I want to say it started at like high 80s, but maybe it is six figures by now.
That's pretty good for just about anybody.
And yeah, and you get an allowance for an office, you know, for a staff and things like that. And the other thing that just came out was a scorecard on how often your alderman shows up and actually votes, and I think the average grade was like a D.
Well, the wire wearer has not been back, right?
Alderman Solis.
Alderman Solis, who's retiring, though, right?
Yeah.
And so he's just laying low now until it's time to get out?
Yeah.
That's going to be fascinating. It's all fascinating. And now we've got an election, and so all but two of the 50 actually have a challenger?
Yeah.
And how rare is that? What's our usual average on how many challengers? Is it only about 50% usually challenged?
You know, I don't know the numbers. I know that having this many challengers is definitely something that we haven't seen in the past few cycles. I mean, having so many seats contested. But, not every challenger is like a strong challenger. But there are some of them where they're like, they're really, you know, kind of going to the mat for the seat. So,
and some wards have multiple challengers. Yes. I want to say the 46th. I've been following Erica Wozniak because we've had her on the show many times, and seems like a great person. And I know people that live up in that area, and there's like three challengers there, I think. So there's some that really have a lot going on.
My ward in the like on the west side, we have three. We have the incumbent, and we have two challengers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them. Wow, what is the city going to look like come
Now,
come
in all of those races, now, when there's three, is it going to be just the top vote getter in the aldermanic, or does somebody have to get 50% of the vote?
For the aldermanic races, I'm not going to say for sure. I should know this, and I don't, and I don't want to give the wrong advice. But I know for mayor, we go into a runoff. Alderman, I want to say there also is a runoff, but... Okay. I don't know. Let's.
So it could be a very interesting spring. And when would the runoff be?
The runoff is early March. It's just a few weeks.
Just a few weeks later, we do it all again. So they got to get all the volunteers again.
There's not like months and months and months. Yeah. Like there's not. It's like 6 weeks. It's a matter of weeks. You know.
So early April, because we're already in March when we're we're almost in March.
Matt, I'm not exactly sure what day it is.
It's only 3:30 in the morning. You've only been following R. Kelly around all day. You only have to be back at court in a few hours. We'll figure all this out. Well, let's visit again before the runoff. We're almost assured of a runoff.
Yes.
So we'll talk again. We'll bring you back.
I'll be a little...
You get your R. Kelly thing straightened out. We'll have just mayor talk next time.
Be a little short, a little sharper next time.
No, you've been great. Thank you so much for staying with us all night long. Kim Bellware, intrepid reporter for... A myriad of places. I can't tell you where because she's freelances for everybody now, but she wrote a great piece for Vulture that is, you can get the link to it on her Twitter feed at Bellwack, B-E-L-L-W-A-K. Kim Bellworth, thanks so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
All right, quick break and then the news on 720 WGN.